Which way will Pompeo go today on the world? I'm Marco Werman. Just weeks into his new job, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is talking tough on Iran, but still sounds open to a deal with North Korea. So the question remains,
will Pompeo join hands with the more hawkish bomb, bomb, bomb inclinations of John Bolton? Or will he maintain a united front with a much more cautious defense secretary, Jim Mattis?
Also, Ireland holds a referendum on abortion this week. And this podcaster wants to hear from women on both sides of the debate.
I felt that what was really missing from the conversation about abortion in Ireland is women's stories.
Plus, higher rents are pushing people out of Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood. These stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you here. 3 weeks. That's how long Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been on the job. But as our first guest on the show today remarked,
well, of course, it's 3 weeks, which feels like 3 years in Washington these days, right?
That's Susan Glasser with The New Yorker. And like us, she's seen the dramas that are already playing out on Pompeo's watch. President Trump announcing the U.S. would withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, a move that scrambles an already delicate relationship between the U.S. and Iran, and could also rupture relations with some of America's closest European allies. Then the very next day, Pompeo's in Pyongyang for some high-stakes diplomacy in a bid to avert the threat of nuclear war. Susan Glasser says Pompeo's plate is really full.
He's landed literally right in the middle of two of the biggest running foreign policy crises of the Trump administration. And at the same time, he's inherited this demoralized, uncertain workforce at the State Department. On the one hand, he's promised to bring swagger back to the State Department. On the other hand, he's up on the Hill today testifying and supporting President Trump's proposed 30% cut of the State Department budget.
Have you heard from people at the State Department how they feel about Pompeo at this point?
I think those two things encapsulate the whipsaw effect, right? After the very troubled, rocky tenure of Rex Tillerson, State Department morale hit bottom. There was a sense that the upper ranks, especially of the U.S. Foreign Service, were thinning out and that diplomacy didn't really have a place in the Trump era. Remember, it was in response to a question about the State Department and its many, many vacancies that Trump said, doesn't matter. I'm the only one who matters. So on the one hand, that's unlikely to be changed just by having Mike Pompeo in there. On the other hand, Pompeo is a very ambitious figure. He understands Washington much better than Rex Tillerson ever did. And he wants to have a success here. And I think he understands that at least some of that perceived success will come from appearing to restore the morale at the State Department. So, you know, they're cautiously optimistic that it won't be as bad as Tillerson, but I don't think any people really have many illusions 15 months in that Donald Trump is going to turn into a standard issue Republican president when it comes to foreign policy.
How does Pompeo appear on the world stage? Is he a moderating force or a voice who's setting the stage for open conflict with, you know, fill in the blank, America's adversaries?
That's the part that I think is still being filled in. What does the new team around Trump, what roles do they play? On the one hand, I think there is a recognition by foreign governments that one of the greatest problems in dealing with Trump's previous team was that both Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster, the also fired national security advisor, that they didn't really speak for the president. They didn't really share his viewpoint. So initially, I think expectations were very high that at least Pompeo would reflect accurately Trump and that he would have influence with the president and so therefore would be a more valuable and reliable interlocutor. However, the Iran deal withdrawal in his very first week in office undercut that argument a little bit with Pompeo because he insisted that the negotiations that the State Department was having with Europeans to find a way to fix the deal rather than to nix the deal. That was the slogan. Pompeo insisted that that was real. And I think a lot of Europeans felt burned by that, frankly. They felt that that was not an on-the-level process and that it wasn't taken seriously by the president.
Secretary Pompeo gave his first major foreign policy speech since becoming the top U.S. diplomat on Monday. Here he is with a 12-point list of demands to Iran.
You know, that list is pretty long, but if you take a look at it, these are 12 very basic requirements. The length of the list is simply a scope of the malign behavior of Iran. We didn't create the list. They did.
Now here's a response from Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. So the Iranian president is saying, speaking about Pompeo, a guy who was in a spy agency until yesterday and has just become the Secretary of State is making strange remarks. He wants to dictate the terms for Iran, saying Iran should do this or do that. This is utterly ridiculous and funny, so says Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Susan Glasser, how did Iran and the rest of the world hear Secretary Pompeo's speech?
Well, it's interesting. Pompeo, I think, in some ways cares a lot more about what his reviews are in the job than Rex Tillerson, perhaps reflecting the fact that he is an ambitious politician, a former congressman, and sees himself having a future in American politics. But, you know, it was a speech that was panned not just by the Iranians, but also you heard very, very tough words on both sides of the Atlantic. You have the Europeans saying, basically, that's not serious. That's aspirational. There's no deal. How can you come back to us and demand that we join you in some new coalition against Iran when we joined with you in a deal that you just blew up unilaterally?
Do the Iranians think Pompeo is all about regime change in their country?
Both Pompeo and John Bolton, the president's new national security advisor, have been longtime very hawkish toward Iran in their rhetoric. I think Trump is now surrounded by advisors. Also, by the way, Jim Mattis, who, remember, his falling out with the Obama administration actually came on the subject of Iran, and the Obama team's view that he was more hawkish than they wanted him to be.
A lot of people on the subject of Defense Secretary Mattis, a lot of people still see Jim Mattis as a moderating force in the White House. How do he and Pompeo get along? Are they, like, do they see eye to eye on anything?
You know, this is the relationship more than any other that I'm fascinated by, because I think it holds the key to understanding what's going to come next. The question of whether Pompeo chooses to maintain a close alliance with Mattis inside in the internal debates of the new Trump cabinet could decide where things are. Will Pompeo join hands with the more hawkish bomb, bomb, bomb inclinations of John Bolton? Or will he maintain a united front with a much more cautious defense secretary, Jim Mattis? That is the debate that we're waiting to see play out here.
Susan Glasser is a staff writer with The New Yorker. Thanks very much for talking us through this.
Thank you so much for having me.
This week, Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg also went into diplomacy mode. He took yet another grilling from lawmakers, this time in Europe. You might remember Zuckerberg was on Capitol Hill just a few weeks ago answering questions about the serious problems with his platform, from fake news to the mishandling of user data. Many of the U.S. lawmakers who questioned Zuckerberg back in April were criticized for missing the mark, even not understanding how the internet works. Take this back and forth Zuckerberg had with Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah.
How do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
So did EU lawmakers also forget to brief themselves on the World Wide Web? We'll get to that in a minute, but first let's talk about one particular issue that came up time and time again during yesterday's hearing in Brussels.
The GDPR.
GDPR.
The GDPR.
GDPR, that stands for the General Data Protection Regulation, a set of European internet privacy rules going into effect on May 25th, in other words, on Friday. The idea is to give internet users within the EU more control over what's done with their data.
So it's about respect for your inherent rights of privacy in relation to things like profiling and collection and the uses that people make of your data. For example, to send you adverts, to make automated decisions about you, all the things that happen in the information society.
Lillian Edwards is with the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. She says under the GDPR, internet users can more easily access and transfer the information companies hold about them. The law applies to so-called controllers or processors of personal data,
which is the technical word really for anyone who holds your data, processes your data, collects your data. So that could be anybody from Amazon.
Yeah, right.
Facebook, but also your local charity, your local shop, the people who keep you on lists to send you coupons. All these people are data controllers.
Will any U.S. companies be subjected to this law?
Well, this is the interesting question. The jurisdiction of the GDPR is fundamentally Europe. It's meant to protect European citizens. But that means that it also applies to American companies and other companies when they process the data of European people, or if they have an office in Europe, or if they offer goods or services or monitor, for targeting adverts, European people. But it isn't a set of rights that's fundamentally meant to benefit Americans who have no contacts with Europe.
But just on that first point, there are a lot of American companies who are processing the data of Europeans.
Oh, completely.
There's been a big push to get U.S. companies to voluntarily extend these protections to U.S. consumers as well. I know Facebook in particular is facing a lot of pressure to do this, but it's unclear if and how they would do it. What do you make, though, of this push to see these standards extended beyond the EU?
Well, I'm fascinated, actually, as an EU data protection lawyer of, you know, over 20 years standing. One of the things we've always taken as a given is that America wouldn't have an interest in these kind of privacy rights, you know.
Why
often
not?
The mantra. Well, yeah, because we had a mantra generally that you were in favor of very laissez-faire regulation for your companies. Although you had good privacy regulation against your government, you know, with things like the Fourth Amendment, you haven't tended to be too stringent on privacy restraints on companies, on the commercial private sector, right? But we seem to have had a sea change somewhere, I think, between the Snowden revelations and possibly now the Cambridge Analytica revelations. I think people are beginning to think, yeah, my data is being used in ways I don't understand. There is profiling going on that isn't transparent. I don't feel I have control over my data. And therefore, I think we're now seeing a big grassroots feeling in the US that they like the same kind of rights they're hearing about that the EU is getting in the GDPR. And it's just very, very interesting to see.
So do you think Facebook should extend these protections, Facebook, for example, to the United States, or no?
Well, that is up to Facebook.
Right, but what do you think?
What do I think? I think they'll never do it, because to do so would be to prejudice completely their business model. I mean, their business model is collecting and monetizing personal data.
So I was going to ask you, I mean, are we looking at a world, if this continues, where European internet users are super protected and the U.S. is going to be the Wild West?
Maybe, but maybe we're also looking at a world where European users don't get as many services as US users. I mean, that's the flip side, right? If it can't make money, will it be supplied? And, you know, it seems really unrealistic to say, oh, people will pull out of Europe. You know, I mean, Europe is the second biggest market in the world, obviously. So I don't think we'll have the apocalypse, but I think, yeah, we may start to see a strange kind of data war, regulatory war breaking out on private turf.
Lillian Edwards there with the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. Now let's go back to that meeting between Zuckerberg and members of the European Parliament, or MEPs as they're called. If you expected European lawmakers would get more answers than their American counterparts, you'll be disappointed. It wasn't so much the questions that European lawmakers threw at Zuckerberg. Those were more pointed, more informed than many we heard on Capitol Hill last month. Like this set of questions from British MEP Syed Kamal on what kind of data the company collects from people who don't even have a Facebook account.
Is the only way of preventing Facebook collecting my data to avoid the internet altogether? Or is there another way? How can non-users stop Facebook collecting their data? And what do you do with the non-Facebook data? Do you commercialise it? And given you do that, is it morally acceptable, do you think, in your opinion, to collect non-Facebook users' data without them knowing what you do with it?
So how did Zuckerberg answer that biggie? He didn't, really. Same with several other big questions. The problem, according to some people, was the format Zuckerberg requested for the meeting. MEP spent a full hour asking questions before Zuckerberg took his turn to answer them. Well, the ones he wanted to anyway. And by the time he started answering, there were only 25 minutes remaining on the meeting clock. Here's Belgian MEP Guy Verhofstadt as the whole thing drew to a somewhat chaotic close.
I mean, I asked you 6 yes and no questions. I got not a single answer. Yeah. And of course, well, you asked for this format, well, for a reason.
Zuckerberg did leave the meeting with a promise to respond to all unanswered questions in writing. And when he does, we'll tell you what his answers are here on The World. Just ahead on the show, Ireland's contentious abortion debate. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Whenever people talk about abortion, it can become very contentious very fast. That's what's happening in Ireland right now. On Friday, Irish voters go to the polls for a national referendum on abortion. The lead-up has seen accusations of dirty campaign tactics and plenty of name-calling. But The World's Matthew Bell recently spoke with one woman who's determined to hear from all sides.
Hi, Kira. Matthew in Boston. How you doing?
Good to hear from you.
I called up Kira O'Connor-Walsh in Dublin after learning about her podcast. It's called The Eighth. That's a reference to Ireland's so-called Eighth Amendment, which effectively bans abortion. On Friday, Irish voters have a yes or no choice. Do they want to repeal the Eighth? As the campaigns for each side ramped up, O'Connor-Walsh had an idea for a podcast.
What you get when you end up looking at both sides is you get quite a lot of the extreme opinions. And what you don't tend to get is any of the humanity behind the people who are involved in the campaign. It ends up being talking heads where two people are just really speaking past one another. And what I really wanted to see was a little bit of, I suppose, the middle ground and try and understand what ordinary, regular Irish people think about the issue of abortion.
One thing O'Connor-Walsh decided right away was to come clean about her position. She's 37 years old, and she's a longtime supporter of abortion rights. She also decided to be open about her own experience with abortion. You said at the very beginning of the podcast that you had traveled for an abortion in Ireland. Of course, most abortion is illegal, so many women will travel to places like the UK. Was that difficult for you to talk about?
It was difficult for me to talk about. Nobody wants to air their dirty laundry in public like that, really. But, you know, for me, I felt that what was really missing from the conversation about abortion in Ireland is women's stories. And silence has been used as a tool for a long time in Ireland to keep things under wraps. And, you know, that's happened across the board in different issues in Irish society. And I think that women telling their stories is really what's going to change hearts and minds here. And so I thought if I was making a podcast and I was going to be asking women to do that for me, that I also needed to share my own story. So yes, while it was hard to talk about and I had to, you know, prime my family and my friends and my partner and his family and, you know, all of the kind of knock-on effects of speaking publicly about something like this, for me, it's worth it because it brings a level of understanding and humanity to a conversation that can become quite clinical quite quickly.
Kira, I want to play one scene from the podcast where you sit down and speak with a woman named Murren, and she tells you this very moving story about how she had a miscarriage. And then it really struck you how you had this common experience, even though you're kind of coming at it from different directions.
Well, you know what? Let me tell you one more story. My first pregnancy was the one that ended in miscarriage. And I remember, you know, I knew it was going south. It wasn't 100%, but it wasn't looking good. I just remember sitting on the toilet, holding my head in my hands, and I said, oh my God. For the first time, I could see where someone facing an unplanned pregnancy was coming from. My body was betraying me. My body was doing something that I had no control over. My body was doing something natural, but something that I just absolutely, I'd have done anything to stop it. I'd have done anything to I was going through, you know, lists of friends in my head who'd done exactly what I did. You know, they'd just had sex and they got pregnant and it had worked out and they had lovely babies. And I had sex and I got pregnant and my own body was betraying me. So, I mean, it's not that it changed my mind, but it totally brought it home to me in a whole new way. Just this helplessness, really. And I don't know if that's what you felt or if that's what everyone feels.
Like, that was actually quite emotional hearing you say that, because that's, you describe me to a T. Like, that was exactly the feeling. Like, you know, I feel like an alien in my, like, you know, in my own skin. I feel like my body has betrayed me and it's something quite natural is happening, but I feel out of control and...
Identical.
We had this moment together where we were looking at each other from different sides of the same issue and where we'd shared our exact, almost identical experience, except for mine was in the case of a termination of a pregnancy. But the feelings were identical. And we just had this big hug at the end where we were like, wow, you know, we shared something very special.
There was another moving story from a young man who tells you about how he would not be alive today, he thinks, if it wasn't for the Eighth Amendment, which bans abortion in Ireland, because he says his mom probably would have had an abortion. Kira, let's listen to a little bit of what Gavin had to say.
So my mom fell pregnant with me when she was 15. She had me when she was 16. The background of my family then wasn't wealthy at all. Working class family background. My mother didn't want to travel to England to get an abortion, right? My grandparents, however, wanted her to, and we had family in England. So they sent her over to England to get an abortion, and she was there. She stayed with a few family members there waiting for the whole procedure. Now, it was in that time that my grandparents deliberated, you know, and methodically thought, okay, well, look, we can't do this. This isn't the right thing to do. So they took her home, and I'm here today because of that.
And that was probably the hardest interview and, you know, one of the ones that had the most impact on me, because, you know, we had great chats. We had a lot in common. He was a philosophy student. I had studied philosophy in college. A really lovely, open, warm guy. And he sat across from me and in a very gentle way, not in a confrontational way and not in an angry way, said, when you see me, do you see Gavin, a person, or do you see a choice? And for me, obviously, that was quite a confronting moment, because of course I see him as a human being and a person with a life and, you know, friends and family and networks. But I did have to say to him, you know, would I have respected his mother's right to terminate that pregnancy? Yes, I would have. And that was an incredibly personal and challenging moment.
Do you think that's a fair question?
I think it is a fair question. You know, I mean, as far as he's concerned, and like he's never going to change his mind about termination of pregnancy because it's so rooted in personal experience. And I had to recognise that that's where he's coming from. And equally, I'm coming from a point of view of having had to travel for a termination of pregnancy and the sort of trauma that comes along with that. And so that's why I'm campaigning so hard and why it matters so much to me.
Do you think you've changed any folks' minds as you've talked to them? Maybe through the podcast, through your conversations or however?
My sister, who was very pro-choice, and then she listened to the episode that you were talking about there with Muireann and with Gavin, and she changed her mind and she became very pro-life. And then she had to go away and really reevaluate her whole position. But she's back in the repeal camp now. She's decided on further reflection. But I think that the pro-life episode really rattled her.
Kira, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Matthew.
Kira O'Connor Walsh is the podcaster who's put out the 8th podcast about all the issues surrounding the abortion referendum that's coming up on May 25th in Ireland.
That was The World's Matthew Bell. I'm Marco Werman. Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood is changing.
This is just what happens in immigrant communities. You see it in communities across the country where, as rent becomes more expensive for a variety of reasons, the people who maybe made that neighborhood over generations are pushed out.
That story is still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Ebola virus killed thousands of people in West Africa in 2014 and 15, and now we're watching another outbreak happen in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The World Health Organization has not yet elevated the outbreak to emergency status, but still, 26 people are dead and there are dozens of suspected cases. We also reported on the show last Friday that the virus spread from mostly rural areas to at least one major population center, the city of Bandaka, and that poses a much wider threat to public health. My BBC colleague Anne Soy was just in Bandaka. I caught up with her earlier today in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. She had just filed a story about a family that broke into a clinic in Bandaka to remove relatives suspected of having the virus.
people are really worried about what it will mean, because basically infected people are very infectious, and that is why they are put in isolation. This family, we understand, broke into a treatment center on Monday evening and demanded to take their relatives out, saying that they did not believe that an isolation unit was the best place for them. They wanted to take them to a church to have the church leaders pray for them instead. So later the police were informed and they started a search. But then before long, two of the patients had died, and the third one has now been returned to the treatment facility. Health workers are very worried about what this means, because it means that the patients have been in contact with members of the community. The people they've been in contact with are being cancelled. The health workers are explaining to them why it is important to isolate patients and how they can protect themselves from Ebola. Some of them, we understand, are also being vaccinated against it.
So presumably the clinicians at that treatment center tried to prevent the family from taking these patients away. But, I mean, generally in Bandaka, what was the mood among locals? Are they trying to leave? Are they anxious?
Well, many people are still in denial, actually, because the information has been going out through radio, through word of mouth, and some people are still in denial. In fact, some even say that they do not believe that there is a disease called Ebola. And so that is really a big challenge, because if people do not accept that there is a disease, there is a problem, then it becomes difficult to begin to deal with it. And I remember during the big outbreak in Liberia, for instance, when the disease got to Monrovia, the capital, and treatment centers were set up in a slum, at some point some slum dwellers broke into the treatment centers to loot. They stole the mattresses that belonged to the patients and to also free their family members. And from that point on, the disease spread really fast. So there is a big reason to be worried now.
The head of the World Health Organization says they are much better placed to deal with the current Ebola outbreak in Congo than they were in 2014, when thousands of people died across West Africa. Does it feel to you like Congo has at least learned lessons from the 2014 tragedy?
They have, and they also have a longer history of Ebola. They've had 8 outbreaks before now, since the 70s, when Ebola was first identified here, and it was actually named after a local river, Ebola River. And so they have had experience dealing with outbreaks of Ebola over time. And the World Health Organization, for instance, I spoke to one of the officials today, and he said they were pleasantly surprised to find that as soon as the outbreak was announced, the government had already positioned teams on the ground to deal with it. But then there are huge challenges which they are receiving support with, dealing with logistics, moving from Kinshasa to the affected areas, and especially in the rural areas. However, there is a sense that the DRC has done it 8 times. It can also deal with this one.
My colleague at the BBC, Anne Soy, their senior Africa correspondent, speaking with us from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, about the latest on the outbreak of Ebola there. Anne, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Here's a tough question. How much will climate change cost? It's been answered in a lot of different ways over the years. And today there's a new study out trying to tackle the economics of climate change. We've got our Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler, here in the studio to talk about it. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco.
So when we talk about the economics of climate change, what are we looking at? I mean, I can think of agriculture and storm cleanup. I also think about the cost to people who are concerned buying a hybrid or an electric car or installing solar panels. What am I missing?
Well, when we're talking economy-wide, you mentioned two of the big ones, disaster cleanup and agricultural productivity. But we can also look at things like worker productivity and how that's impacted by climate change, healthcare costs. And as policymakers are trying to decide what to do to prevent climate change and how much to spend to do that, there are increasing efforts to look at economy-wide, globally, how much climate change would cost if we didn't do anything to stop it.
I mean, it seems like a big question, almost too big, but these are the things that people who are smart wrestle with, supposedly. So how are these researchers trying to answer this question?
So the three Stanford researchers who just published a paper in Nature today looked at the historical relationship between temperature and GDP in 165 countries over several decades. And then it used that data to try to predict what would happen under various future scenarios. So if countries stick to the promises they've made under the Paris Agreement, it looks like the world will still be something like 15 to 25% poorer by the end of the century than we would have been if global warming stopped now. That's not going to happen. We're already on a trajectory to continue warming. But they found that if we actually limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the most ambitious goal written into the Paris Agreement, we'll prevent about 10% of those losses in GDP, saving something on the magnitude of $100 trillion. And that would dwarf what it's expected to cost to reach those carbon mitigation goals.
What about certain sectors of the economy? I'm thinking agriculture or just general human productivity. It seems like there would be some industries and factors that could actually fare better and benefit in a lot of places if it got a few degrees warmer.
Yeah. So what was interesting to me about this analysis is that these researchers found that there's sort of a temperature sweet spot for economic productivity. So places where the average temperature is somewhere between 50 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit have the largest economic growth. So as it gets warmer, cold places in northern climates like Iceland, Northern Europe, Russia will actually have faster economic growth. Whereas warmer places closer to the equator will have slower economic growth. But on the aggregate, because some of the biggest economies are a little closer to the equator, China, the U.S., Japan, globally, if we keep it cooler, the economy will do better.
Let me just kind of challenge the whole methodology of this study, because, I mean, we're looking at the consequences of not dealing with climate change now in the year 2100. Isn't that really hard to predict?
It is. If you think about how hard it is to figure out how the stock market's going to be doing in a year, that'll give you a sense of how hard it is to predict total economic output in 80 years. So there's a lot of variation in these different estimates. This one is considered to be a bit more holistic than those looking at different sectors and how they might fare. And it also found bigger impacts than some previous studies. But I think it's important to mention that this study and other conversations about economics and climate change all have something in common, which is that the biggest and most severe impacts will be felt in warmer countries closer to the equator. They stand to benefit the most from us limiting climate change, and even small changes in carbon output could help those economies a lot.
The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler, thank you for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Our next story is also climate-related. It's about sea level rise. Now, the highest point in Florida is only about 350 feet above sea level, Britton Hill on the Panhandle. So high ground in the Sunshine State has high value, especially with oceans rising. That reality is getting hammered home for residents of Little Haiti in Miami. For years, it's been home to a large community of Haitian immigrants and their families. But here's the thing. Little Haiti is high enough above sea level that it doesn't flood, and it's centrally located. Real estate developers and investors are taking notice and cutting deals. And Haitian-owned businesses say they're being pushed out. WLRN reporter Nadege Green has a story.
Wolin Vieljean looks through a selection of white wedding gowns inside his store in Little Haiti. He's the owner here at Vieljean Tuxedo and Formal Wear. He hands a poofy gown to Daniela Eugene. She's 17 and drove up from Key West to shop here.
I like this one because she's pretty. She's make me beautiful.
This store is a go-to for Miami's Haitian community, for weddings, proms, first communions. And Vieljean has run it from this spot on 82nd Street and Northeast 2nd Avenue for 32 years. That's about to change. The building has a new owner who also purchased the property across the street. Vieljean says the news was a shock to the mostly Haitian-owned businesses here because now they're being told they have to leave. The new owner, Thomas Conway, has asked about a dozen businesses to move out by the end of May. Conway is a well-known developer in the area. He's putting up a new food hall here and owns a co-working space, too. What he plans for these two new buildings is unclear. He did not respond to repeated requests for an interview.
Good morning. Bonjour.
The Haitian businesses and supporters called a press conference to ask for more time to move out and to address the changes in Little Haiti.
To me, this is gentrification at its worst right now.
Claudine Vilson is a community organizer with the nonprofit FUM, Family Action Network Movement. She helped rally the business owners. She said there needs to be a plan to protect small businesses that made up the neighborhood before it became trendy.
Do we count or do we not count? That's my concern. We count. And our voice needs to be heard. It does matter.
Pierre Maximilian runs a travel agency in one of the buildings with a new owner now. He's been here for 9 years and says the new landlord is shutting out Haitian-owned businesses and isn't giving them any options for staying.
He is killing the Haitian business, you know, and what we were doing for the community because we are serving the community.
Maximilian wants to stay in Little Haiti, even if it means paying a little more. He says when he asked if he could rent a smaller space once renovations are complete, the response was,
your rent is going to go much higher than what it is. And I said, how much higher? He couldn't tell me exactly.
The attorney for the new landlord wouldn't comment on future rent charges. It's not just the business owners who say this will affect them financially. Jean-Lucas is sweeping in front of the storefronts. He does odd jobs for several of the Haitian businesses. Sometimes he gets picked up as a dishwasher. He says he doubts the new businesses will hire him because he doesn't speak English that well, and he can communicate with the current business owners in Creole. For Ville Gilles, the owner of the formal wear store, his doors are still open for now. He's pinning a client's dress for alterations. He looks up and he says, he knows he's at the end of his 3 decades running his shop in Little Haiti. He says he can't afford rent here anymore. And soon, he'll move Ville Gilles Tuxedo and formal wear to North Miami, 15 minutes away. Willem Ville Gilles worries he'll lose a lot of customers, that they won't know where to find him and think he's just disappeared.
Reporter Nadege Green joins me on the line now from Miami. Nadege, how long has Miami's Little Haiti even been around? Like, what's the thumbnail of its history, and how did Haitian immigrants manage to land the high ground in the first place?
So the area was established after the first wave of Haitians started coming here and settling in the area, like 1980s, I want to say. Mm. And the name was coined Little Haiti by Vital Gist. In Creole, people refer it as T-I-E-T. But it has been a place over time where Haitian migrants would come. It was the center of the Haitian social scene. It was the center of religion. All the Haitian churches were in that neighborhood. All the Haitian restaurants were in that neighborhood. But over time, as the Haitian community gained wealth and their socioeconomic status went up, many people moved out of the neighborhood. And so now it's not as concentrated anymore with just Haitian-owned businesses.
So you said at least a dozen Haitian-owned businesses in Little Haiti are set to shut down or relocate. Will that effectively gut the economic vitality of the neighborhood?
I don't think it'll gut it entirely, but definitely a significant portion. I think we've seen over time Haitian-owned businesses leaving, trickling out. So you would see two businesses leave, and sometimes they leave and you don't know why they leave. But sometimes you do know. There was a thrift store in Little Haiti on Northeast 2nd Avenue last year that shut down, and they actually called a press conference before they closed saying that they simply couldn't afford the rising rent costs, but they didn't want people to think they just disappeared. They wanted to explain their absence in the neighborhood, which was it is becoming increasingly more expensive as development happens around the community, as new people move into the community, that they just simply can't afford the commercial rent costs anymore.
And I gather it's not just Little Haiti that's changing. There's also a similar change to the landscape in Miami's Little Havana, right?
It's happening all around. The thing is, in these neighborhoods specifically, you have the more expensive neighborhoods that border them, but people can no longer afford there. So you go north or you go west. Brickell, which is a very high-end neighborhood, very expensive, borders Little Havana. And so you're seeing the blocks that border Brickell, people call it West Brickell. It's actually not West Brickell. It's Little Havana. Mm. And the business owners are saying that, stop calling us West Brickell. We're Little Havana. Because once you put the name Brickell on any number of blocks, you expect your rent to go up.
Right. What sets these stories in Miami apart from other stories of gentrification all across the country?
I think this is just part of the national story of what happens. This is just what happens in immigrant communities. You see it in communities across the country where as rent becomes more expensive, as housing become more expensive for a variety of reasons, new people will move in. In Brooklyn, we've seen it. In Harlem, we've seen it. And with the new movement of
different folks coming into the neighborhood, and with commercial rent costs going up, the people who maybe made that neighborhood over generations are pushed out. Many of the folks in Little Havana, many of the people who live in Little Havana are older and are on fixed income. And so if you're dealing with rising rent costs, if you're not a homeowner, ultimately you end up getting pushed out as the prices go up. And if you don't own the commercial spaces in this case for these business owners, you also end up getting pushed out.
WLRN's Nadege Green on the changes afoot in Miami's Little Haiti and Little Havana. Nadege, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Not everyone liked Philip Roth. His fiction could be rude and brilliant, sometimes misogynistic, but also angry with all humanity, often bitingly funny. Like him or not, Roth was one of the towering figures of American fiction. He died last night at the age of 85. Roth was often referred to as a Jewish American writer, though he bristled at that. He said he wanted to be known as an American writer who described a uniquely American experience. His writing also spoke to an immigrant experience, so we called up two writers, both Russian immigrants to the U.S., who felt a connection to Philip Roth. One of them, Sasha Senderovich, wrote this on Facebook, quote, "I first read Portnoy's Complaint at age 20 on my first trip back to Russia after living in America for 4 years. I laughed hysterically. In retrospect, I missed a huge amount of nuance, but I think the laughter made me somehow feel American for the first time." End quote. Here's Sasha.
Probably one of the things that spoke to me then was that Philip Roth, being the first generation American Jewish writer, was in some ways closer to me as a first generation immigrant. And Alexander Portnoy's family, the loudness of the family, the invasion of personal space by members of the family, the kind of neurosis that living in such close quarters with the anxieties of being Jewish in a, you know, hostile environment at that point. For many, many of those things reminded me of being Jewish in the Soviet Union and being a Russian Jewish immigrant in America.
Senderovich made a second trip to Russia that year, and he had another seminal Roth experience. It was 2002, and he was flying from Moscow to London with a stopover in Zurich.
So I remember arriving at the airport in Moscow, and I had all kinds of troubles because this was 2002. They were stopping me on the street all the time because I thought I looked like a Chechen terrorist. The car, which, you know, was taking me to the airport, was stopped at the sort of on the highway because they also kind of facially profiled me. So there's all sorts of like ways in which getting to the airport was difficult. So I was starting to be paranoid that I'll never make it out of Russia, which is a fear common to, I guess, immigrants. When you return, you can't make it back. So I remember, and I had just read all of the Zuckerman trilogy by Philip Roth, the end of which is this epilogue, which is a little novella called The Prague Orgy, the protagonist of which is this American writer who goes to Prague during the communist period in the 1970s to take out a manuscript by this writer who was killed during the war, and he wants to bring it back to America. And he's sitting in the airport in Prague in the 1970s, and he's thinking, Swiss air, the sweetest word in the English language. So I remember getting to the airport in Moscow, you know, and they were announcing flights to other parts of the former Soviet Union. And then suddenly there was like my flight to Zurich on Swiss air. I'm like, ah, I get it. This is how it felt.
Philip Roth sort of defines the Jewish American writer, and he has a kind of a monopoly on being that figure.
That's Anya Yulenich, a Russian-born American writer. A couple of years ago, she came out with a graphic novel called Lena Finkel's Magic Barrel. There's a scene in the book where her protagonist, who's also a female Russian-Jewish immigrant writer, is on a Greyhound bus. She falls asleep, and she has a nightmare that the passenger sitting next to her is Philip Roth.
She sees Philip Roth, an elderly Philip Roth, sitting in the Greyhound bus seat next to her. And she says, oh my God, Philip Roth, is that really you? Aren't you too famous to be taking a Greyhound? Listen, I love your books. You and I are so much alike. It's like we had the same parents. And then Philip Roth says, oh, stop that. You're nothing like me. First, you're a woman, and then not even a pretty one. Second, you're an immigrant. You've only been to a psychiatrist once. You're a perverse hybrid of Alexander Portnoy and his mother, an ugly creature, Finkel. And then she gets really mad. and says, "You're so mean. Guess what? I hated Exit Go so much I threw it in a subway trash can." That line is actually autobiographical. "I threw Exit Ghost in the subway trash can." It was a while ago, so I can't really exactly remember like the plot, but I remember there was this prolonged descriptions of this young woman's sexual love for a very old man. Actually, it's a book that's connected to his other book called Ghostwriter, which I loved. And I thought Ghostwriter was so radical and wonderful, and Exit Ghost was just this kind of masturbatory fantasy of an old man. And I got annoyed and I threw it in the subway trash can.
You could say that Anya has a love-hate relationship with Philip Roth.
He's really, really good. He's also very enviable because he has a kind of freedom that, as a writer, I feel like I don't have, and my character as a writer feels that she doesn't have. You know, for example, when Portnoy, you know, when he's a teenager, he has sex with this liver that his family then cooks for dinner. I absolutely wish that I had the internal freedom, and also that the sort of literary marketplace allowed freedom to women to write the same way about their teenage sexuality. But women are living as writers in a little jail of politeness that Philip Roth never, you know, he was never very polite.
No, Roth was never polite, at least not in his fiction. He wrote about lust and male sexuality, but also about aging and fame and identity and America, and few, if any, have ever done it better. It's worth remembering that Philip Roth had the privilege to have his voice heard when it came to the Jewish experience in America. This is a country where many voices try to be heard. Sometimes you find those voices not in America, but really close, and we should listen. In Tijuana, Mexico, the group Mint Field offers a unique voice and vision of life in a border town that faces America. It's contemplative music, trance-like at times, and I don't know about you, but it's not what I expected from Tijuana. Minfield is a duo, Estrella Sanchez and Amor Amezcua. They grew up looking through the border fence, living amid and tapping into multiple Mexican cultures, in the shadow of the myriad cultures of the U.S. And now they've parlayed that into a space that is really the cutting edge of Tijuana music. We'll close with another track from Minfield's new album, Pasar de las Luces. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.